Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine Podcast Radio. You're about to listen to an episode of The Uncommon Journey Podcast with Alyssa Miller, Chloe Mazdaghi, and Philip Wiley. The trio focuses on the unique journeys that people take to break into cybersecurity and the value of diversity for this industry. Many personalities share their stories and encourage those interested in starting a career in InfoSec to embrace their unique backgrounds, even when not technology-related. Enjoy the journey. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Uncommon Journey Podcast. It's me, Alyssa Miller, and I am here with the two most amazing co-hosts I could ever ask for, Philip Wiley.
Hey, Alyssa.
And Chloe Mazdaghi.
Hi, everyone.
So, this episode, the humanitarian, the fair wrestler, and the pre-med student walk into the InfoSec bar, and we've got a designated driver this week. She's hanging out at the table, and we're going to sit down and talk with her for a while. Hey, everybody, it's Katie Paxton Fear. Katie,
Hey, how are you? I'm good. How are you?
Doing great. Super excited to have you here with us. So let's just get started. For those that maybe don't recognize your name or aren't familiar with some of your work, tell us just a little bit about who you are.
So my name is Katie. I'm a full-time PhD student in machine learning and cybersecurity. I'm a part-time educational YouTuber, occasional bug bounty hunter, and I'm still waiting for the Nobel Prize to get back to me on what I'm sure will be probably one of the most requested prizes I've ever given for more hours in the day. Yeah, it's good to be here.
If I had a place on the committee, you'd have my vote. I'm just, what hats to wear? Holy cow. Awesome. So you mentioned a lot of the work that you do, and I want to just start beginning by kind of exploring where you've been. How did you end up here of all places? Doing a lot of the work that you've been doing in the ML space and so forth.
It's quite the story. So I have a bachelor, like most people, I have a bachelor's degree in computer science. That's how you do a PhD. Then I actually had zero interest in security. Couldn't be bothered with it. Thought about it and thought, that seems really difficult. So I went into machine learning instead. And I'm sure most people in security would perhaps have the opposite opinion there. So I went into kind of developer and data scientist and machine learning. And I had a very interesting job working out what data to give salespeople so they could make a sale. The most interesting job on the planet, as you can be sure. I lasted 6 months before I was like, I need to get out of this job. I am so bored. So I ended up applying for a PhD. And my PhD was really the very first time I've even been like exposed to cybersecurity professionally. So I've been doing my PhD in June 2019. I ended up being invited to a live hacking event, which then got me going from kind of what you might think as like corporate-ish more cybersecurity, which is what my PhD is in, to actually hacking stuff, which then kind of set off doing live hacking and doing hacking and then making YouTube videos. Yeah, it's it's been a journey for sure, and that's like 3 years of my life.
Yeah, you do a great job with your YouTube videos. That's something I highly recommend for anyone wanting to get into bug bounty. I think it's some of the better produced videos on how to get started.
I pride myself on the fact my videos are really long, not because I want to, like, I think a lot of videos tend to be a bit more on the clickbaity side. Like, look, I can teach you hacking in 10 minutes. No, you can't. My videos are long because they have to be, and I treat them as more like lectures. Quite a lot of the like audience of my videos are people who wouldn't necessarily be able to access university level education because of like financial reasons or They live in countries where, you know, they have to work because they have to support their family, or countries that don't necessarily have the same level of education as you might expect in somewhere like the UK or the US. Not that their degrees end up worth very little, it's that it's a large financial investment to make for essentially something that won't get them to where they want to be versus practical skills, which I think is where my videos meet that kind of really nice niche of being a university style without the university price tag.
Yeah, that's great. Good to have someone that's skilled at teaching like that. That's one of the things I'm a big fan of the bug bounty space, is the fact that you're opening up opportunities to people that wouldn't otherwise have it. Like you're talking about the education, you know, some people can't afford the education, but it's nice that people can get into security and make some money through bug bounty. So that's one of the things I kind of like about that. So how is it? Have you done very well on your bug bounties? Are you, you know, making some money off of it, or just pretty much just a pastime for you?
The money definitely is nice. It's not really a major motivator for me. I don't necessarily have the time to, even like some of my followers have more in bounties than I do, because I don't really have the time to hack very much anymore, because I spend a lot of time making YouTube videos. But, you know, I put myself out of a job ready for my followers to come in and grab it out of my hands. In terms of bounties, like, I've got, I think, what most people would consider more on the lines of, like, not necessarily pocket change, not necessarily a life-changing amount of money either. Not the kind of people on Twitter you see, like, here's my new Lamborghini, and here's the other new Lamborghini I bought, and here's it next to my third one. I'm sitting there being like, yay, I got my salary twice this month. I won't get it twice every month, but think about how much yarn that is. Because I knit, and I've spent more than enough of my bounties on yarn for knitting.
Yeah, that's great. I see that you've been getting some sponsors too, so it's kind of nice to have some help with your expenses to buy your equipment and stuff required to create your content.
Oh yeah, I've actually been able to buy a microphone. Before I got my first sponsorship, I didn't have a microphone. I've been able to have like video editing equipment and like Photoshop, and it's been a huge change. That and Patreon as well have been so amazing to actually help me invest in my channel where I wouldn't usually be able to. Like, I'm a student. As much as being a PhD student, it's kind of cool because you get paid to get your degree. I don't have to go in debt for my degree. It's still not that much of money, like in the grand scheme of things. It's still a student salary.
Very cool.
So, Katie, I have a question for you, because I know that there's a good number of people that want to become YouTubers in the hacking space. And there's also some pretty, you know, our closest connections and whatnot that also do YouTube pages. But they ran into some issues here and there on YouTube. Do you mind sharing a little bit about that, the past situations, and what we can do as a community to help prevent such situations from occurring?
So one of the big things that's happened to not just my channel, but a bunch of my fellow YouTubers, is that we get our videos removed. Now, YouTube has a policy about no hacking videos. Now, as you can imagine, the hacking videos on YouTube tend to be, here's how you get free V-Bucks in Fortnite, or here's how you hack someone's Facebook account. Like, very obviously, illegal hacking. YouTube can't tell the difference, though. So when it sees our legal hacking and the here's how to hack Facebook 2020 working version, it can't tell the difference, which is surprising, because I, on my channel, get spam bots saying, want to learn how to hack, WhatsApp this number. So they can get rid of my videos, but not even the illegal hacking anyway. So what tends to happen from this is our videos get removed, our videos get demonetized, all of the fun things I'm sure people are sick of hearing YouTubers talk about, but it's a real problem, because if you get one of these strikes, it starts out as being harmless. If you get three strikes, then you start getting these kind of consequences, like videos being removed, videos being taken down, your channel getting removed, which is fine if you say it gets caught accidentally. When the algorithm is particularly picking up videos related to hacking, well, your entire video list can very quickly cause your channel to be deleted. And it's happened to people. People get their videos removed. And if you want to help, the best thing you can do is show YouTube that these videos are fine. Like, don't the kind of people who interact with Facebook videos, very different to the people that interact with educational content, by sort of doing two things. One is by kind of making a fuss whenever YouTube does this, because then YouTube will know better. And two, by just interacting with videos. If you like educational content and you think this is really useful, writing a comment that's not, oh my God, I want to learn how to hack Facebook, is really helpful in kind of showing that it's good non-malicious stuff.
So are there any organizations or movements right now that are happening trying to help push some of this? I mean, it seems pretty daunting from a position like yours to be trying to go up against someone like Google/YouTube, who, you know, have obviously massive amounts of inertia behind them, whereas, you know, this collective of people making videos who aren't necessarily organized together. Is there anything happening in that way, or anything from a community perspective that we could do to kind of drive more of that organization?
Well, hacking is not a crime is something that comes to mind kind of instantly as being a kind of community-led movement to helping kind of make that distinction, as being kind of the main one. Things like, you know, there's a lot individuals can do in spreading the fact hacking is not a crime. If you have somebody who's like maybe a bit older, doesn't necessarily understand the difference, telling them there's a difference, labeling yourself as a hacker, not a criminal, a hacker. It's like, a hacker is to like a criminal what a locksmith is to a burglar, right? And I think making that distinction super clear in not just this kind of online InfoSec community, but reaching it out to other people is really useful.
And I know the people listening can't see this, but I'm smiling ear to ear right now, because the whole locksmith burglar thing is something I just used. It's the exact metaphor I used 2 weeks ago with some reporter who is arguing this exact same topic with me. I had reached out, they had an article, of course, bemoaning all the horribleness of hackers. And I'm like, hey, wait a minute, you know, can we talk about who hackers are versus who cyber criminals are? And so it's awesome that you're talking about that. We had Brian McInnich on a few weeks ago as well. You know, he's obviously the one kind of leading the hacking is not a crime movement. And I know a lot of us are involved in it. And it's something, of course, we all believe in. What about other platforms? I mean, I guess that's the other thing people always seem to ask, like, why don't you just get off of YouTube and use Twitch or use, you know, some other platform for putting your video out there? What is it about YouTube that makes it so special?
Well, first off, I have what maybe to other people is not that many Twitter followers. I think is quite a lot of Twitter followers. I think I have like 17,000. That's huge. I looked up like how big of a like a stadium could fit that many people and then visualized that stadium being full, and it terrified me. But what you see there is like, oh yeah, I have a rather large Twitter following. But actually, of those people, some of them are friends I know. Some of them are people in the bug bounty community who I know quite well. Some of them are my YouTube viewers, and some of them are people who really aren't interested in my content, but for some reason follow me on Twitter. Now I have 18,000 YouTube subscribers. And when you think about it, considering I started out with zero, my channel has grown somewhere. And that can't have all been from Twitter, because in a way they're kind of cyclical. Using YouTube as a platform lets creators have a much larger reach than they would otherwise. Like, you think about a platform where, you know, it's only you and other cybersecurity content creators. I got to be honest, I sometimes don't watch a lot of cybersecurity related content. Sometimes I watch a lot of videos of people playing The Sims, and having a platform that can recommend me both cybersecurity and The Sims content, well, perfect, right? And I think a lot of people feel the same way. They like the way YouTube can, you can recommend content and you can see a variety of content. So it's great for discovery for creators. So it would be really nice to go, oh yeah, I'll just move everything over to a new platform. But in reality, something like YouTube offers us a really big platform, and it offers us a great collaboration space as well, because I'm not the only person who makes YouTube videos. Loads of people make YouTube videos, and it means that other cybersecurity content creators, I can reach out, we share a platform, we can cross promote our videos. I can kind of have that larger reach, as well as a reach within kind of people that would already be following the kind of same topic, as well as people who follow other creators who I don't even know about yet.
When you first started in Bug Bounty, what were some of the obstacles that you faced? And what is some advice you have for those that are wanting to make it big in Bug Bounty, or just don't even know how to get started? Because I know you probably get that DM quite often.
Okay, let me start out by sort of saying how I got into Bug Bounty. So when I went to university, and I think one of the best things about university for me was the ability to meet people from many different backgrounds, not just people I would always interact with, people that I wouldn't necessarily interact with in the course of like my degree. So one person I met was a bug bounty hunter. So I would say I knew what it was vaguely. And I was invited to go to a HackerOne event because he has been bug hunting on HackerOne. He was familiar. He said, hey, they've got this mentoring program. It's going around the community groups. You know, you can apply. If you can get down to London for this day, then you can come along. And I thought, no, thank you. I'm not interested. And then, you know, typical peer pressure. He then got me to go along. So the second I stepped through that door, I knew what bug bounty was vaguely. And that's it. And I'd never hacked anything. I didn't know anything about bug bounty. I knew that HackerOne was a company. Couldn't have told you that BugCrowd existed. Couldn't have told you that there's other like platforms out there. Couldn't tell you the difference between, you know, a remote code execution or a template injection or whatever. So I walked in that room knowing nothing. And I walked out of that room a few hours later finding two bugs. So in terms of what you need to know to get started in bug bounty, the answer is very little, as I prove almost every day. When it comes to learning bug bounty, the most important thing is really, there's kind of two stages. One is to understand how the web works. You're mostly going to be attacking web pages. You should probably understand how the web works. The second is then to understand the tools. So understand how Burp works, understand how your web browser makes requests and how that interacts with Burp. The next step is to learn what bugs are out there. So you can watch my videos to do that, but there are books, there are tons of learning resources that aren't my content. But you should watch my content because I get ad revenue if you watch it and turn ads on. And also then it's like how to exploit it. So when you go from having kind of how to exploit it, you're then looking at kind of more practical resources like CTFs or labs and that kind of thing. So these are the kind of few steps. To get started, you don't need to know anything, but maybe how the web works. And I recommend learning how to use Burp as your first step. And then you'll be in the same position I was when I found my first bug 2 hours later.
That is awesome. I like the way that Chloe left me out of like, yeah, we're big fans of bug bounties. I think that's because she knows I just like to pick fights with Martin Mikos, but you know. I mean, hey, it happens. But no, that is, it is terrific. And I actually do, honestly, as much as Martin and I have had a few good conversations, we'll call it. I like it because you just described what I think makes it so valuable to the community. Yeah, it's a great, it can be a great program, obviously, for organizations. And I think organizations who are that mature in their security posture otherwise should be looking into it. But yeah, from a community perspective, it is a great place for people who want to be here and gain knowledge to have kind of that low bar of entry as far as just you don't have to. You're not trying to get hired for a job where they expect you to have 5 years of experience and certifications and, you know, experience with 20 different tools. So I love that you bring up that perspective. So how do you see this kind of progressing for you, given that whole thought? You're doing the bug bounty thing. You're uplifting a lot of people, which is great. And you're working on this PhD now with the cybersecurity and ML focus and so forth. What's next for you?
So I'm quite happy to say I've got a job, which in a pandemic, I think we should all be thankful that, you know, we're in an industry where we can actually remain employed. A lot of people don't have that luxury. So I'm quite happy to say that I've managed to find a job. I finished my degree in February. Whew. No pressure. It's only a few months. I have to write an entire book. It's fine. And that's what I keep telling myself every single day. And then I won't die of stress. But yeah, I've got a job. I'm going to be a lecturer in cybersecurity. So real students will be able to sit through my YouTube videos now, presumably as YouTube videos, since there's a pandemic on and in-person classes are cancelled. So poor students have to also pay for my YouTube videos. But I also don't get paid for that. So I really kind of played myself here, because there was a genius business idea here and I've squandered it away. But no, I'm going to be a lecturer in cybersecurity. I'm really looking forward to it because it will allow me to have that bit of teaching with the research and sort of continue what I'm really passionate about, which is doing interesting stuff and then telling people about it. Very complex career goals. But that's always kind of been my thoughts, is just do interesting things.
Yeah, based on your content, I'm sure you'll be a successful lecturer. So,
well, YouTube was one of the reasons I got hired. YouTube and bug bounties, actually, they decided and said, yeah, it's obviously you're very passionate about security. And when they were saying, oh, how can we engage students in learning when you can learn it free on YouTube? And I was like, I have thoughts on this because I also make videos. So yeah, one of the reasons they cited for why they were so interested in hiring me was because I kind of had that 20, like, the university kind of stuck in the past a little bit. I don't think anyone will say that they're not. They're very much focused on this one very specific way of educating people, which is on a factory line. You know, you go through, you go to year one, then you go to year two, then you go to year three, and then you leave. Done. Now you're educated. Have fun in the wider world. But actually, turns out that model doesn't work for everyone. And there's a lot that can be done by universities to make that kind of model more open. That, to be fair, you can learn a lot from how YouTube works and how YouTubers engage their viewers to look at how you can engage students.
Well, hopefully they pay attention to you, because, I mean, this is a YouTube generation. You're creating content that people are interested in. And if you can, anytime you can get students interested in learning, that's a good thing. So I really look forward to following your teaching career.
You know, there's kind of a careful what you wish for story in all this too. You know, industry is kind of pushed back on the education side of things and academics to take care of getting people ready for cybersecurity careers. And it's interesting you mentioned that very structured one way of doing things approach that is really just baked into how we educate people these days. And, you know, in an industry where we value diversity of experience and so forth, and we need it if we really want to be successful, maybe we don't value it as much as we should yet. It almost feels like if you're going to educate everybody according to the same standards and the same processes, you kind of miss out on that. Where, like, you've shared with us personally your very unique story and how you got into security, and we wouldn't want to lose that necessarily. So here's a question. Maybe I hope it's a fair question. How do you think we could approach that from an academic sense, where we could sort of build more of that diversity into our approach in education?
I think there's something to be said for the fact that students are not as dumb as some education establishment seems to think they are. Like, we assume that students are 18-year-olds, just want to party, just want to have fun. Students care deeply about the quality of education they're receiving, because at the end of the day, they're paying money for it. And even in a country like the UK, you know, maybe that's not as much as, say, an American student pays for. you still got to pay for it, and you still got to see some value out of the money you're investing essentially in your career. And I think what really university can offer in terms of, you know, listening to students is quite a lot, and see how students want to do it. You know, some students work part-time. Offering more part-time courses, don't just expect everyone to want to do a degree in 3-4 years and then finish it. Offering more flexible learning routes, offering, you know, a greater difference of courses. Not everyone wants to do any penetration testing. Not everyone wants to go into digital forensics. Some people are like want to be developers and want to take one cybersecurity course on, like, say, web security, and that's what they're interested in. I think there's a lot about being flexible in how we educate people that we can really kind of learn from students almost, you know, ask them what they want from their education, because they, to be fair, likely already know what they're missing, likely already know what they want, because they want to have, sounds bad saying it, name brand recognition. What a degree is someone else signing a piece of paper that says, I know stuff. If you don't have a degree, you kind of have to sign that piece of paper yourself or forge your employer's signatures, because they probably don't have time to write you a reference. You've probably just told your boss what you want him to say in the reference anyway, and he's just put his name on it. So what you kind of get is somebody else signing that and like proof someone else has signed it. But actually there's quite a lot apart from just offering that certificate. You know, whether that's engaging with industry, getting, you know, students into industry, offering flexible ways of, you know, whether that's here in the UK, we have industrial placement years, so where someone will have an internship for a whole year somewhere. Whether that's engaging students in research, you know, students want to do interesting stuff, cool stuff. And if you give them the chance, they're going to snatch it from you. They're more engaged than some people seem to think they are. There's so much we can do. And I think getting over that mindset, one, of educating students like they're things on an assembly line, and they go through process one, then process two, then process three, then we can ship them off to a job. Instead, looking at it as not just that, as like this way of thinking, this way of approaching new subjects and teaching new subjects, not just production lines. And also engaging students and engaging industry and being that kind of liaison, if you like, between kind of industrial areas where, you know, you've got business A would like a penetration tester. And here is student B who is a really good at or really wants to learn penetration testing. Don't even need to be good at it. Would you like to consider them for an internship? That kind of role as well. So I think there's a lot of roles that education can play.
Coming from a research background myself, what were some of the research papers that you've read that made a huge impact in your career or in your research career?
Okay. In my thinking in general, this is not related to my PhD. For my bachelor's degree, in the UK, you do like a final year project or a dissertation, and you basically write up a thesis. And it can be a project of your choosing, though most people kind of go with an assigned project. I went one of my choosing, which was deciphering ancient languages. Not, as it turns out, that far from what I ended up doing in cybersecurity, funnily enough, as, you know, cryptography is kind of the source of all cybersecurity. But at the time, it felt very much archaeology. And one of the papers I read, it's a really old paper on this one language. And what was incredible to me, as somebody who's kind of grown up with computers, and this paper was from 1928 from memory, but I'm not sure, by a woman called Alice Koba. And her work actually ended up being like completely ripped off by a male counterpart, which was, you know, very both 1920s and a little bit 2020, actually, as it turned out. But this kind of great paper by Alice Koba about deciphering ancient languages, and the way she approached this problem was so computer-like, it was spooky. She was analyzing these like tablets and comparing similar symbols across different tablets and trying to find those that basically matched. She was basically inventing this algorithm for this one problem when she didn't even have access to a computer. What she had access to were cigarette cartons, because that's the only paper she could get, because it was like the Depression and paper was hard to come by. So that was an incredible paper on like me personally, when I sat back and I thought, this would be easiest to do with a computer. And I thought about it and realized how much of a feat it was to do it without a computer. And that kind of changed my way of thinking of being like, I'm a computer scientist, I do computers, to actually, if I take a step back, computers are one way to solve a very large range of issues. And one of which in this case was this problem of ancient language decipherment, but actually that applies to more than just that. For my PhD, basically all my work is based off of these like manual models. And one of the pieces of my work has been to look at ways you could use machine learning to step in for this kind of very large amount of human labor, just to allow analysts to actually, or analysts in industry to actually use the research, when actually before it's very difficult to use without having this large amount of manual labor. So very different papers, one of which could be replaced with a computer. The other one, I kind of actually did it, related in a little bit.
While attending uni, what are some of the side clubs and projects that you were involved in?
I was very involved in the computing society at my university. And when I say very involved, I mean, I basically ran it for 3 years. I ran it up until the point that I could not physically run it anymore. And quite a lot of my life revolved around doing something for the computing society, getting presenters in, getting swag or merch done for people. A lot of that, but I was very happy to see that at least 1 year after I graduated, it did continue. As for other projects I did during university, I did a lot of hackathons at university. One of my favorite hackathon projects was this kind of really weird idea, which was this kind of like, you know, Twitch plays Pokemon, where everyone on Twitch like says which button to press. We had this idea for like Twitch watches videos, and it was this kind of like a cable box that would be set up in such a way that you could vote on what cable channel you wanted to watch. Very weird idea, though. Interesting enough, I probably would have had a watch of it, because see what people would have done, and see just how many episodes of TLC shows we would have ended up watching together.
I don't know, Chloe, I am out of questions. It's that lightning round time. Chloe's got this little thing. It's supposed to be 10 questions originally, and it never seems to be just 10 questions. So what do you say, Chloe, you ready to go?
Yep, let's do this. All right, Katie.
Yep.
What's your favorite city in the UK?
Manchester.
And if you could attend any university ever, which one would you go to? Would you stay at the one that you're in or a different one?
Both my the first university I went to for my undergrad was one of the lowest tier universities in the country. But you know what? You never meet better people than like people that come from all walks of life. So I would not change a thing about my education. It was fantastic.
Lovely. Okay. So have you ever been to Scotland?
No, actually.
You have to go to Edinburgh. It is my second home.
I was going to, there's like Edinburgh Yarn Festival, and I was going to go last year, but we ended up making plans like the weekend before and couldn't go.
Okay, so next time I'm in the UK, would you be okay with taking a day trip up to Edinburgh with me?
Yeah, sure.
Excellent. Okay, next question for you is, how do you take your tea?
I don't drink tea. I only drink coffee.
Oh, well, there we go. You answered my other question, which is, what do you prefer, coffee or tea? How many cups of coffee do you have a day?
On a good day, one. On a bad day, two or three. I'm not too big of a coffee drinker.
Gotcha. What's your favorite season?
Season?
Mm-hmm.
Toss up between winter, because I like when it snows, but it doesn't always snow, and autumn, because it's cold and it gets a bit chilly.
What's your favorite book?
I don't have one, though right now I am reading Fake Law, which is an exploration of the UK's legal system, which is far more interesting than it sounds.
Nice. Okay. Next question for you is, what's your favorite movie?
I don't really watch movies.
All right, then what's
your favorite ashamed to admit.
TV series?
Pardon?
What's your favorite TV series, Ed?
Avatar The Last Airbender.
Gotcha. Okay. What is the one thing that you collect that no one knows that you collect?
That no one knows? Oh, actually, I do have an answer to this.
Okay.
train tickets from the UK. I used to go up to my parents' shared visitation. I used to get the train to my dad's. So I started out that way, and I just literally have a giant stack that I don't know what to do with now. I just keep every train ticket I've ever purchased.
So we got to add Edinburgh and St. Andrews to that in Glasgow.
Yeah, sure. Why not?
Okay. Next question for you is, what is the your favorite place in the world?
My favorite place in the world? Wherever my fiance is, it's a sappy answer, but I love him to bits and my life wouldn't be complete without him.
I'm not going to ask any more questions. Oh. That was like the cutest thing I've ever heard. Thanks for answering my quick round of questions. I don't know if that was 10 or more or less.
I mean, Chloe, we know every week it's more than 10. Come on, let's be honest. But it's okay. Katie, it's been wonderful talking with you. Really glad to have you on the show here. Last thing, where can people go? What's the easiest way to find your YouTube channel or find out about the other things that you're doing?
I'm so proud of this. You can Google me now. I weren't able to Google me before, but I'm Googleable now. One of the weirdest things to be proud about, I'm very aware, but you can Google me, Katie Paxton Fair. You can also look up Inside a PhD. Now, that's not Inside a PhD, but Insider as in Insider Threat. And that's not PHP as in the programming language, but PhD as in the doctoral degree. Yeah, I'm aware I probably should have picked something that was perhaps less ambiguous.
I mean, for most, I think that's pretty unique. So hopefully, if nothing else, hey, when we tweet this out, you'll see her handle on Twitter. Go find her, check out her work. It is really awesome stuff. But that's all the time we've got. So we gotta fly. As always, it's been a wonderful conversation here on The Uncommon Journey. And on behalf of Chloe, Philip, myself, go vote, wear a mask, do the things. Let's get through this together. Have a great couple weeks, folks. We'll see you again soon on Down the Road. Take care.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of The Uncommon Journey podcast. If you learned something new and this conversation made you think, then share ITSPmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.